Warning! Today's story contains graphic violence, some sexual content, and parts of it are just plain soulless. I wouldn't recommend it for children.
Escape Pod 67. August 17th, 2006. Today's story, Life in Stone, by Tim Pratt.
Hello, and welcome to Escape Pod. I'm Steve Ealy, and once again this week we're brought to you by Invasion, now on DVD. Invasion's the hot science fiction series about bizarre happenings in a small South Florida community after a hurricane. Get caught up in The Invasion, the complete series, now on DVD. It's been a while since I've talked about other fiction podcasts. As often as we release flash fiction, I don't know how anyone could need more entertainment during the week. But if you do, there are a lot of new projects lately that I'm pretty excited about. A gentleman named Nat Thompson emailed me about a new fiction community he's starting up called Obsidian River. He calls it free-flowing fiction in podcast form. You can submit your own stories to their feed, and listeners can subscribe to everything or to a single author or genre. It's just in the startup phase right now, and they still need to get a few things nailed down, but it's a cool idea, and I'd like to see it take off. You can find that at obsidianriver.com. There's a lot going on in radio theater-style fiction, too. I mentioned Spaceship Radio before, and they're still going strong. I've lately become a big fan of Dakota Ring Theater, which is a sort of revival homage of old-time pulp radio. They're doing a few different series. My favorite so far is The Adventures of Canada's Greatest Crime Fighter, The Red Panda. I've also been in touch with the folks at Sonic Society, who have a ton of original series playing at once across all genres. Their main site at sonicsociety.org is a little confusing to navigate. It's easier to go straight to their podcast feed at sonic.libsyn.com and start slurping up all the content. Their latest project is an original Firefly story, and it's off to a great start. And of course I have to give a shout out to my friends at Amazing Pulp Adventures, starring Mr. Adventure! It's exactly what it sounds like, fun superhero stuff. New episodes are on the way, and they've got the coolest looking webpage in podcasting, at pulpadventures.net. And finally, I've got to plug my own little project. Last Friday we launched the world's first podcast horror magazine, Pseudopod. It's officially a sister podcast to Escape Pod. My friends Merle Lafferty and Ben Phillips are the editors. It's a paying market, and it is completely free, supported by donations. Our first story is an intense ghost story by Scott Sigler called Bagman, and I love it. Unlike Escape Pod, all of the content is adults only, and we do not guarantee that it'll get you to work feeling good about life. Check it out at pseudopod.org. That's P-S-E-U-D-O-P-O-D. In celebration of that, we have, well, I think it's a darker story than Escape Pod usually runs. It's also a strong fantasy, and in my opinion, very beautiful. We present Life in Stone by Tim Pratt. Mr. Pratt sold to us before with Lacrimose and the Golden Egg, and his collaboration Robots and Falling Hearts with Greg Van Eekout. He's also a senior editor at Locus, the magazine about science fiction, and his novel The Strange Adventures of Ranger Girl is available from Bantam. I've read it, and it's weird, wild, western, and wonderful. This story first appeared in the late lamented Lenox Avenue in winter of 2004. So, put your conscience aside for a rainy day. It's story time. Life in Stone by Tim Pratt. After ascending 72 flights of iron stairs, creeping past tentacled sentinels lurking in pools filled with black water, and silently dispatching wizened old warriors armed with glaives and morning stars that proved a close match for his pistols and poisoned glass knives, Mr. Zealand, at last, stumbled into the uppermost room of Archibald Grace's invisible tower. All Zealand's earlier murders were mere journeyman work compared to this final assassination, the murder of a man who'd lived for untold centuries, who'd come to America and enslaved buffalo spirits, who'd built this tower of ice and iron on the far side of the Rockies as a sanctuary and stronghold for his own precious life. Zealand rested for a moment, catching his breath. He got winded so much more easily now than he had as a young man, and he didn't sleep well anymore, which made him jangly all day, most days. He leaned against a filigreed pillar of white ivory, a tusk or bone cut from some prehistoric, possibly ahistoric, leviathan. Archibald Grace had doubtless slain whatever monster this ivory came from. He was a killer of such stature that even Zeelan found himself humbled. Grace had murdered monsters, while Zeelan had seldom killed anything but men. He ran his hand along the spiraled carving on the pillar, one of a dozen in the round tower room, and then he walked to the arched open window. He looked down from the tower's lunatic height onto the small town of Sincaguas, just another little place in the valley, whose inhabitants were unaware of the magical edifice rising on the outskirts of town, an invisible spire so high that Zeelan could look down on a slowly gliding California condor. Having regained his breath, Zeelan turned to face the center of the room. He unzipped his black canvas shoulder bag and reached inside to touch the haft of a stone-headed axe, an ancient implement fitted onto an unbreakable carbon steel handle. Zeelan approached the center of the room, passing the pillars, and saw what he'd been led to expect, a square box, 2 feet to a side, resting on an ivory pedestal. The box was a simple thing, made of aged wood worn so smooth that the grain was nearly invisible. Zeelan drew one of his remaining knives, this one made of ceramic, and used the blade to pry open and lift the lid. The box was empty. Zeelan stared at the space inside for a long time, going so far as to probe the inner edges with his knife, looking for a false bottom, but there was no such concealment. The stone simply wasn't there. Despite all the effort he'd spent making his way to the top of this edifice, there would be no reward. He'd learned long ago that mere effort didn't guarantee success, but this was an especially bitter reminder of the fact. Zeelan sank to the floor, sitting cross-legged, resting his head in his hands. He was too old for this by at least a dozen years. In his younger, hungrier days, such a setback would only have infuriated and energized him, given him an adrenal surge and a slow-burning determination to soldier on, but he'd long since grown out of such dedication to his work for its own sake. For many years, he'd crafted an image of himself as an implacable night stalker, relentless avatar of death, and he'd seen his work as a sort of nightmarish inversion of a holy mission. But he'd just turned 45. He suffered chronic lower back pain. He found it increasingly embarrassing to sleep with prostitutes less than half his age, and he'd spent the past dozen birthdays and New Year's Eves alone in his home amid the redwoods above Santa Cruz, California. He'd lost all illusions about his career. He was neither avenging angel nor cinematic assassin. He was simply a man who'd spent a lot of years killing people for money. This job was more of the same, despite certain Baroque complications and supernatural curlicues. Though there was the promise of something more than money as payment, if he succeeded in taking Archibald Grace's life. Zeelan got to his feet. No use mourning the moment of failure. Better to push himself, weary or not, onward to the possibility of success. He reloaded his pistols and redistributed his knives. Now he had to make his way back down to the foot of the tower. Maybe the guards wouldn't harry him so if he was only trying to leave. He could hope for that much. The next day, Zeelan met his client, the thus far immortal Archibald Grace himself. They shared their usual booth at their usual Italian restaurant, Grace drinking cheap house wine, Zeelan sticking to water.
"Damn," Grace said. "I thought for sure I'd left it there."
Grace looked like a young man, with a neat black beard and eyes the clear blue of synthetic sapphires.
"You were sure you'd left it in Mammoth Cave, too," Zeelan said with practiced patience. "Sure you'd left it in the Great Sequoia Forest, certain it was in your old summer palace at the bottom of Lake Champlain, and positive it was hidden behind Niagara Falls. I'm beginning to suspect you need a tutorial in the proper meaning of the words sure, certain, and positive."
"I am sorry," Grace said, looking into his wine. "You can have ownership of the tower, of course."
"Oh, good," Zeelan said. "It'll go nicely with the mud-slime cave full of ghosts behind Niagara, and the sinkhole decorated with obscene pictographs in Mammoth Cave. Though I admit the palace in Champlain is nice. If it weren't also the den of an aquatic monster, I might even go back there. I'd like the tower better if it weren't full of homicidal beasts and your wizened homunculi."
"There's a phrase to stop them from attacking you," Grace said, making a familiar grasping motion with his left hand. "But I've forgotten it. I've forgotten so many things."
He still stared into his wine, as if he might find his missing memories at the bottom of the glass. Zeelan,
who was not a man given to casual gestures of physical affection, reached across to touch Grace's hand.
"Don't worry," he said. "I will find your life, and I'll crush it. You will die."
"I'm sure it's in North America," Grace said. "I moved everything with me when I came here. I came with the..."
He made the grasping motion again.
"The Vikings," Zeeland said, sitting back. "On the longboats. You've told me."
"I brought my life, my soul, hidden in a stone. Or perhaps an egg."
Grace cupped his hands around a half-remembered roundness.
"All the wizards and witches and giants and monsters knew the trick, to put your life somewhere safe so your body couldn't be killed. So long as your life is safe, you live. We used to hide our souls in tree trunks, until the witch hunters began putting whole forests to the torch. As the trees burned, the souls burned, and sorcerers screamed across the continent."
He clucked his tongue.
"Then, for a time, it was fashionable to hide your life in the head of a toad. But toads are stupid, and often get eaten or die. I was always smart. I hid my life well."
"I know," Zeeland said.
"But I've forgotten where I put it."
Grace looked up from his wine into Zeeland's face, and for a moment it was clear he'd forgotten who Zeeland was.
"I've forgotten so many things. It's hard to know which things are worth remembering when you don't have a soul."
"I know," Zeeland said again.
"I used to be a giant." Grace looked wistful. "Before I was a man, I broke the spines of mammoths in my hands. But I've forgotten how to be a giant, and I don't want to be a man. I only want to die."
"I know," Zeeland said for the third time.
3 times was usually enough to make Grace stop going over the usual elusive reminiscences again.
"Where should I look next, do you think?"
"Look for what?"
Grace said, blinking his beautiful eyes.
"Come then," Zeeland said. "I'll take you home."
Some weeks later, after another pair of fruitless searches for Grace's life, Zeeland crunched through the snow-covered sand on the shore of Lake Tahoe. The water was still and blue, and though there was no wind, the cold was bitter and penetrating, making the inside of Zeeland's nose burn with every breath. A woman stood on the edge of the water, a long black scarf hanging motionless down her back, her thick down coat the red of arterial spurt.
"Are you Hannah?" Zeeland asked.
She turned, the lower half of her face covered by the scarf.
"Mr. Zed," she said, her accent precise.
Her eyes were the color of the water, almost the color of Archibald Grace's own, which made sense, as Hannah claimed to be Grace's daughter. When she'd first contacted him, Zeeland had been suspicious, partly because Grace's apparent sexual preference made the presence of offspring rather unlikely, but upon further consideration, it was understandable that someone as old as Grace would have tried various partners and sexual permutations, probably many times over. Hannah had known things about Grace that Grace barely remembered about himself, and Zeeland was reasonably certain her claim was true.
"You told me you know the whereabouts of your father's life," Zeeland said.
He was still fascinated by her eyes, so like Grace's.
"I do. I'll take you there, but you have to do something for me first."
"I'm not prepared to wait," Zeeland said.
His tone was polite, but the menace was implicit. She laughed, harsh and hyena-like, quite unlike her urbane voice.
"Father has lived for epics. Another day or two won't matter."
"Nevertheless, I want you to tell me now."
She pulled the scarf down. Below the eyes, her face was inhuman, with 2 holes covered by membranous flaps where her nose should have been. Her mouth was lipless, filled by a score of 2-inch-long interlocking incisors. She resembled nothing so much as a deep-sea fish, one of those horrors fishermen occasionally pulled up in their nets, and Zeeland recalled Grace's claim to have spent years living beneath the sea. When Hannah spoke again, her mouth did not open, and Zeeland realized that her human voice was a magical contrivance, not something born of her own vocal cords at all.
"My father is almost a god, and my mother was the mistress of black oceanic caves. I will decide where we go and when."
Zeeland drew a pistol and fired a shot, blowing off Hannah's right knee. She screamed, this time opening her mouth, and it was an inhuman gurgling sound. She fell to the sand, throwing her head back into the snow, her monstrous teeth spreading apart, her long tongue lolling out as she shrieked. She had a bioluminescent bulb on the end of her tongue, glowing a sick yellow. Zeeland put his gun away, wondering if he'd made his point sufficiently. Hannah had stopped screaming, so perhaps not. feeling himself cloaked in a kind of prevailing numbness, what he had long thought of as his working state. Zeeland put one heavy boot down on Hannah's right thigh, just above her destroyed knee, then bent over to grasp her ankle in both hands. He wrenched her leg upward, grunting and twisting, pulling on her ankle while pressing down on the thigh with his foot, until her lower leg came free with a sickening pop. Hannah lashed and flailed at him, but the pain made her imprecise. Zeeland noted with interest that she didn't bleed, though the wound seeped clear water. He hurled her lower leg into the lake, then stepped away from her thrashing limbs.
"I hope you're part starfish, or that leg might be gone forever. You'll tell me where to find your father's life now."
Tears ran from Hannah's eyes. Her screams had subsided to whimpers, and the whimpering didn't stop when she spoke in her magical human voice. Both sounds emerged simultaneously. "I only wanted to see my father again. I wanted you to take me to him. I've hated him for too long, hated him for his essential nature, and I wanted him to know that I forgave him, if he would forgive me." Despite her obvious agony, her voice remained clear and barely modulated.
"Your father has something like Alzheimer's, but more profound. He doesn't even remember your existence."
Zeeland had asked Grace if he knew anyone named Hannah, and Grace had given him that blank, desperate look and grasped at the air, but that was all. He'd been quiet and morose for hours after Zeeland asked him, though, and Zeeland suspected that Hannah's name had set up unpleasant resonances deep inside Grace, below his conscious mind.
"But since he doesn't remember you, it means he doesn't hold a grudge for whatever drove the two of you apart, if that's any comfort."
"His mind is gone."
"Not entirely, but it is degrading more every day. I think it comes from having lived so long without his soul."
"You intend to restore his soul to him?"
Zeeland shook his head. Hannah stared up at him, her monstrous jaw clenched.
"Then you will kill him, destroy his life?"
"It's what he wants. It's why he hired me."
Zeeland gestured with a gloved hand.
"You've exhausted my patience once already. Are you trying to do it again? Direct me to your father's life."
"I have to show you."
Zeeland sighed. He trudged up the shore to his car and returned with his tool bag. He withdrew a pair of bolt cutters and snapped off Hannah's teeth, one at a time. Then he flipped her over onto her stomach and bound her hands behind her with thick plastic loops that tightened with a tug. He picked her up over his shoulder and carried her, his knees creaking under the combined weight of Hannah and his tool bag. At least she didn't thrash. He was breathing hard by the time they reached his car, an SUV rented under a false name. He put her in the passenger seat, and after a moment's thought, pulled the scarf back up over the lower half of her face. Looking at her broken teeth and glowing tongue made him feel uncomfortable, and a little guilty, the latter an emotion that had plagued him more and more in recent years. His working state was already fading, and the emotions that replaced it were not welcome. After he got into the driver's seat, Zeeland said,
"Guide me."
Zeeland crouched on the edge of a creek in a wilderness area in the mountains above the lake. Hannah lay on her side in the snow nearby. Zeeland was exhausted. He'd carried her nearly 2 miles from the trailhead, most of that well off the path, falling twice when the treacherous snow and ice gave way beneath his footsteps. His knees ached, and his feet were numb inside his boots, but he'd made it. Hannah had led him to a pretty place of tall pines, cracked gray rock faces, and a rushing mountain stream.
"It's filled with rocks," Zeeland said,
staring down at the bottom of the wide, swiftly flowing stream.
"It's white, speckled with red, egg-shaped, almost as big as your fist," Hannah said.
Zeeland saw the stone, half buried among water-smoothed rocks. He pulled off his glove, pushed up his sleeve, and plunged his hand into the water. It was deeper than it seemed, and he had to submerge his arm past the elbow before he could reach the stone. He grasped it and pulled it out of the water. Zeeland's whole arm was numbed by cold, and he thought briefly how nice it would be to feel that way all over, inside and out, just cold and aching nothingness, the way he felt on a job, but forever. He couldn't even feel the texture of the stone in his hand, just the weight, which was greater than he would have expected. He held Archibald Grace's life in his hand. Dropping the stone into his coat pocket, he walked to where Hannah lay in the snow.
"Thank you," he said. "Would you like me to kill you now? I can be quick."
"No!" Hannah shouted, her eyes wide.
"Your wounds are grievous," Zeeland said.
"I'll heal."
Zeeland looked down at her for a moment, then nodded. He thought she probably would. She was Grace's daughter. He squatted on his heels in the snow.
Tell me, before I decide what to do with you, how did you find Grace's life?
It was in his tower at St. Cogwis. I used to play there as a child. There's a room that opens onto the ocean, onto the caves where I was born, so I could travel freely between them. I went to the tower last year, and Father hadn't changed the passphrase, so the guards led me through. I thought I could make my father talk to me if I had his life, that I could use the stone as leverage. But I couldn't even find him. Then I heard you were working for Father, that you'd been seen around his old haunts, searching for his life. I didn't know he'd hired you to kill him, so I contacted you.
I suppose you regret that now.
I only regret not being able to talk to my father. I'd gladly give up a leg for that chance.
Life is disappointment, Zeeland said, and he'd never meant any three words so completely. He pondered the possibility of mercy. I can throw you into the stream, he said, or I can leave you for the coyotes.
Stream, she said, without hesitation.
And if I let you live today, will you come for me later and try to kill me?
Never.
Liar, Zeeland said,
almost appreciatively. He picked her up by her one good leg and the straps that bound her wrists, swung her a few times, and tossed her into the stream. He stood in the snow long enough to watch her wriggle away, eel-like, and disappear over the falls, flowing back down toward the lake. Zeeland kissed Grace just behind his left ear, and Grace moaned and moved his body back against him.
I found your life yesterday, Zeeland said. Not 40 miles from here.
Grace went stiff in Zeeland's arms. They lay together in a wide, soft bed, mountain morning light filling the window and the room.
And now you want to use it to control me, Grace said, his voice heavy with disappointment, but not surprise.
Zeeland put his hand on Grace's slim, bare thigh.
No, he said. I just wanted to spend one more night with you before smashing your soul apart.
Grace relaxed.
Good. That's good. I've lived for eons. Another day doesn't matter much.
Zeeland shifted uncomfortably at this echo of Hannah's words. He shouldn't have treated her with such brutality. He was tired of doing things he regretted, tired of feeling ashamed, tired of bad dreams. How nice it would be to become immortal and let his regrets drain away or freeze over. Apropos of nothing obvious, Grace said,
It's easier to be a sorcerer when you don't have a soul. It's easier to do the awful things you have to do when you know the true sensation and emotion will be forgotten in the aftermath.
Not for the first time, Zeeland wondered if Grace could overhear his thoughts.
How does it feel, he asked, putting your soul aside?
It was an important question, and one he hadn't asked before.
It's been so long since I had my soul, I don't recall the difference.
Grace rolled away and sat on the edge of the bed. Zeeland looked at the muscles in his unblemished back.
Fear is the first to go, which is liberating. Then other feelings fade. Your memories go, but it's the bad memories first, so it seems a boon. Finally, the conscious will to live erodes, and you become like a moss or a lichen, living for the sake of mere existence. But you retain your mind, and so there is some dissatisfaction, some sense of...
He grasped at the air.
Eventually, you long for death.
Do you wish to die even when you're with me?
Zeeland said.
Grace shrugged. Perhaps moss enjoys the sensation of falling rain, or the warmth of sunlight, but that's not meaning, it's just pleasure.
Without turning around, he said,
Do you still want your payment for killing me? Do you still want me to show you how to be immortal?
Zeeland didn't answer. It had seemed obvious before. An immortal life, free from self-doubt, self-loathing, and fear. Of course he wanted that. He touched Grace's back. Despite their time embracing, Grace's skin was cool, almost cold. Zeeland didn't answer Grace's question, and after a while, Grace forgot he'd asked, and went into the kitchen to get a piece of fruit. After they made love a final time, after Grace taught Zeeland the trick of putting his soul aside, they went out onto the deck that jutted over the cold blue vastness of Lake Tahoe. Here on the northern shore, houses were fewer and farther apart than on the more tourist-friendly south shore, and they had a clear view of snowy mountains and evergreens. The brisk air made standing on the deck a bracing experience, and Zeeland slid his eyes against the lake wind. He placed the spotted stone that held Grace's life on the redwood deck railing. Grace didn't seem interested in it. He just gazed, wide-eyed, at the mountains,
as if seeing them for the first time. "Go ahead," he said. "I'm ready." Zeelan raised the old stone axe with its unbreakable handle. He thought about touching Grace, or kissing him, but the time for that had passed, and hesitation would only make this harder. He brought down the axe, and shattered Grace's life. The spotted rock burst apart, and light the color of Grace's eyes shone forth, blazing so brightly that even when Zeelan squeezed his eyes shut, he saw blue. After a moment, the light faded, and Zeelan opened his eyes. Grace sagged against the railing, his whole body trembling, and when he spoke, his words were choked by sobs.
"I have a daughter,"
he said, and then began pounding his head against the deck railing, slamming his forehead down so hard that the wood audibly cracked. Grace looked up at Zeelan, his forehead gashed, blood running into his eyes, and screamed, "Finish it! Kill the body!" Zeelan lifted the axe again and brought it down between Grace's eyes. The man's forehead caved in, and the axe stuck there, embedded in Grace's skull, trapped fast in bone as old as the mountains. Grace fell back on the deck, dead. Zeelan went inside for the tarps and the chains he'd need to sink Grace to the lake bottom. His hands trembled as he wrapped Grace in the heavy plastic. The dead man had shaped nations, seduced monsters, and lived to the outer extremes of experience. But he died like anyone, like so many others at Zeelan's hands, messily, and speaking only of regrets. Zeelan sat by Grace's corpse, holding the dead man's hand for a while, and contemplated the nature of immortality. Zeelan sat in the upper room of the tower at Sincaguas, holding an oblong piece of shaped marble in his hand. The stone was prepared according to Grace's instructions, as a receptacle for Zeelan's life, and he could never make another. This was one-time magic, once-and-forever magic. Zeelan heard the distant scrape and clang of weapons on the lower floors. He'd claimed possession of the tower with a passphrase he'd learned from Hannah, and then he changed the phrase to one only he knew. But the guards were old, and Hannah knew her way around, so he was not surprised to see her limp in through the arched doorway. She apparently did have some starfish in her ancestry, because her leg had grown back, though it was knotty as coral, and a bit shorter than the other leg. She wore the slashed remains of a dark blue wetsuit, and she bled water from the wounds the guards had inflicted. Her teeth had grown back, too, though they curved off at strange angles, and some of them cut her face when she closed her mouth. "You killed my father," she said, her voice emerging from the air before her, a calm statement of fact.
"He wanted me to," Zeelan said. "He didn't stand up."
"I don't care. Because of you, I never had a chance to talk to him and make things right between us."
Zeelan rolled the marble egg between his palms. "He mentioned you in his last words. He said he had a daughter, and I've never heard such anguish."
"He remembered me?"
"He remembered everything, and I think he wanted to die even more once he did."
"I came here to kill you," Hannah said, but she didn't come any closer.
"I thought you might."
He held up the stone so she could see it.
"I've been up here for weeks, trying to decide if I should put my life in this rock. I've never been an indecisive person, but I've been balanced on the edge over this."
He glanced up at her, then away, and said,
"I'm sorry for the way I hurt you."
He set the egg on the stone floor. Hannah sat down beside him. She smelled strongly of salt water. "My father never told me he was sorry for anything."
"He wasn't capable of being sorry, not while his soul was put aside."
"I'm sure that made his life easier."
"Hmm," Zeelan said. "Are you still going to kill me?"
"Perhaps. Did you love my father?"
"As well as I was able. But I may as well have loved a cloud or the stars, for all the feeling was returned."
"I know how that feels." She picked up the marble egg. "I don't think I'll kill you. Not just now."
"I almost want you to. It would take the decision out of my hands. I wish I knew where to go from here."
She laughed, that harsh hyena sound, and Zeelan realized that her laughter, unlike her voice, came from her own throat. "No one knows that." She put the marble egg back in Zeelan's hand. "Not even my father knew where to go next. He just knew he was going to keep going on forever, until you helped him find forever's end." Zeelan nodded. He stood and walked to the tower window and looked down at the earth far below. Hannah came and stood beside him.
"It's a long way down," Zeelan said.
"Looked at another way," Hannah said, "we've come a long way up." Zeelan squeezed the stone in his hand.
It was cold and hard, and didn't yield at all under the pressure of his hand. He thought about irrevocable decisions. Zeelan dropped the marble egg out the window, and Hannah stood beside him as they watched it fall.
And that was our story. There are a lot of SF stories about the price immortals pay for being immortal. This is one of the few stories I've read that presents the before and after problems. We had some really good feedback to last week's episode, The King's Tale by Constance Cooper. There's a very interesting thread going on in the comments section about the most alien aliens. Solaris, from the Stanislaw Lem novel, was mentioned a couple of times. Also the Motis, from Niven and Pornell's The Mote in God's Eye. And one lower light brought up the AI, Jane, from the Orson Scott Card novel, Speaker for the Dead. I'd love to hear more ideas from you guys on the subject. It could make a really good future intro. Most of the rest of our feedback was about the start of our 2-week ad campaign. I'll talk about that feedback later, because this week we're brought to you by the hot new series Invasion, now on DVD. Journey into the unknown with park ranger Russell Varon and his new wife, local television reporter Larkin Groves, who face strange events while living in a small Florida community after a hurricane. Find out how the town reacts to strange glowing beings in local waters and other bizarre occurrences. Get caught up in the invasion, the complete first season, now on DVD. Finally, one other commenter, who signed only as a neuroscientist, said, "I love the story and the reading. One slight quibble. In response to the excited reader getting his jollies from the computer voice, you joke that Steve Jobs must have a direct line into your hippocampus. The hippocampus is an area of the brain involved in forming new memories. E.g., the movie Memento portrays a man whose hippocampus is damaged. I think you meant either the hypothalamus, involved in the sex, sleep, and hunger drives, or the ventral tegmental area and nucleus accumbens, both involved in the dopaminergic pleasure pathway. Sorry to nitpick, I actually thought it was cool that you mentioned the hippocampus at all." And thank you for the correction, sir. That's what I get for writing too quickly and relying on dictionaries for fact-checking instead of Wikipedia. I'm glad you mentioned it. If you hadn't, Sully Dog would have brought it up eventually. He's a neuroscientist too. But now I get to tell him, "Yes, doctor, I know." And in appreciation, we've got an upcoming flash piece dedicated just to you. You'll know it when you hear it. Escape Pod is released on a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. So if this podcast were, say, a resident of the tiny town of Homestead, Florida, aliens would be completely free to copy it, as long as they didn't change it, and as long as their plan wasn't for profit. All other rights are reserved by our overlords. I mean, authors. Edit break. Take out the word overlords. A final reminder that I'm going to be at Worldcon next week. Come and see me at the Escape Pod Party Suite or any of the 9 panels I'll be on. Jeez, I'm insane. And then I'll be at Dragon Con the week after that, where I'll be doing the Daily Dragon podcast. Escape Pod should continue uninterrupted during this time. That's the beauty of time shifting. And if there are any technical problems or my head explodes, well, I'm just going to blame the ugly horror of time shifting. Our music is brought to us by Daikaiju. Did I mention that they'd be playing at Dragon Con? Did I also mention that Anders Manga, who does the theme music to Pseudopod, will be playing at Dragon Con? Or that the friends of Escape Pod, Ego Likeness, will also be playing at Dragon Con? So go to Dragon Con, people. And if you have any hearing left at the end, you just weren't trying. That's our show for this week. We close with the famous words of Woody Allen, who said, "I don't want to achieve immortality through my work. I want to achieve it by not dying." Until next week, have fun.